This is the politicalbetting.com Polling Matters podcast. My name is Kieran Pedley. On this week's show, we were back in the TV studio and I was speaking to Stuart Wood, who's a Labour peer, Oxford academic and an expert on US politics. And I was also speaking to Mike Smithson of politicalbetting.com. And we discussed the US Super Tuesday results, obviously a big week in the US elections this week, where we saw Super Tuesday, that day being the day when the most delegates are up for grabs for those candidates vying for their respective parties' nominations. So we discussed some of the results and implications there. And then later on in the show, we looked at events closer to home, where we discussed all manner of things, including the EU referendum, but also looking at the Labour Party, considering that Stuart is a Labour peer, and talking a little bit about what Labour should expect in May's elections. And obviously there's a whole host of elections in the devolved assemblies, in the English local councils, in the London mayoral, of course. And we discussed kind of what Labour should expect and what a good and bad result might be in the context of Jeremy Corbyn's Labour leadership, a leadership that looks quite strong at the moment. So we started the conversation with myself going through some of the results from Super Tuesday and then discussing what that all means. And you're about to hear that conversation. Before I bring you guys in, let's talk a little bit about some of the results from last night. Obviously, lots going on. On the Republican side, of course, Donald Trump winning 7 out of the 11 states available, but it didn't have it all his own way. Texas, Oklahoma and Alaska were won by Ted Cruz, and Marco Rubio broke his duck, so to speak, winning Minnesota. But, Stuart, what do we make of the Republican race at the moment? It looks good for Donald Trump, doesn't it?
It looked good for Trump. I mean, he is a favourite. He's still not as much of a runaway favourite as I think Hillary Clinton is in the Democrat race. On the one hand, he didn't do quite as well as some people predicted. He was expected last night by some people to win 10 out of 11 states. He only won 7. Cruz won 2 states, so his tally's up to 3. Rubio, as you say, broke his duck. And in no state did Trump really run away with it. I mean, Massachusetts, I think he nearly got 50%. But in no state did he get 60, 70%.
I think I saw Nate Silver say that his current total is 34% of the vote.
Yeah, he's consistently in the mid-30s almost everywhere. And in fact, that's his great strength to flip it over. I mean, he wins everywhere. I mean, he can win in the West. He can win, as he showed in Nevada. He can win in the South. He can win evangelical Christians that were supposed to be part of Ted Cruz's southern sweep. It turned out not to be much of a sweep, more a little brush. And he can win in the North, as he showed in Massachusetts, where there's more moderate liberal Republicans. So the fact that he can win everywhere, I think, is an extraordinary thing, or anywhere is an extraordinary thing. I think also yesterday was the day that the Republican establishment view of Trump, that he was a maverick who would eventually be found out, I think that was finally dismissed. And I think the big issue going forward, we'll talk about this maybe in a bit, is how the Republicans combine to try and challenge him. I mean, Trump's delegate count, we'll see in a minute, is high, but he's still beatable, but it requires a lot of things to go against him and for a lot of coordination. That really is the game, as it were, in the Republican race from now on, I think.
I mean, on the Democrat side, we see that Hillary Clinton dominating in a similar, but maybe not the same way as Donald Trump, winning in Alabama, Georgia, Tennessee, Virginia, Arkansas, as we might expect. She took Texas, whereas Donald Trump didn't. Bernie Sanders winning in Vermont, Oklahoma, Minnesota and Colorado. I mean, Mike, what's your sense of the Democrat race? It feels like Hillary Clinton's pulling away.
Yes, but I thought that Hillary was not expecting to lose 4 states last night. I think she was expecting Vermont, which... Bernie Sanders there was the biggest winner anywhere. He won about 85% of the vote. That is his home state. But I think that Oklahoma, Minnesota and Colorado weren't totally predicted. And I think that has taken a slight edge from it. But in terms of overall delegates won on the night, it is very difficult to see how anybody other than Hillary Clinton can be the Democratic nominee.
Let's talk a bit about delegates, because obviously, as we know, it's not about the popular vote. It's not even about how many states you necessarily win, although that obviously comes into it. It's about the delegate race. And if we look at this, which was true at the time of publishing, shall we say, for those listening in, Hillary Clinton are 1,001 delegates. A lot of those are super delegates, of course, who are already sort of predetermined, if you like. Bernie Sanders on 371. Before we go on to the Republicans, Stuart, I mean, do you share Mike's view that it looks good for Hillary?
It does look good. I don't think there's going to be a decisive moment when she just sort of breaks free and that's the end of the race early. I think she'll be ahead and continue to be ahead, and it will be a a longish kind of race. I mean, Sanders has a lot of money, a lot of grassroots, small donations giving him a pretty decent amount of money. He does well in border states with Canada, in the northern Liberal states. He does pretty well. And he may well, you know, bring off a couple more results, as Mike said, like last night, which are slightly against the odds. But I think the other thing to note in the Democrat race is that those delegates are at the moment, in the Democrat race, they're all allocated proportionally. So you don't get the dynamic we're about to get in the Republican race, where after March 15th, if you win a state by one vote, you get all the delegates. And that will show some big jumps. And it might bring a Trump victory very early, or it might bring a sort of closer contest very early. You won't see that dynamic in the Democrat race. I think you'll see Hillary staying ahead and sort of pulling further and further ahead without a knockout blow very early.
Mm. Let's look at the Republican race, certainly the one that's captured the most attention, I think, as people start to think that Hillary Clinton is inevitable. 1,237 plus one delegates required. Donald Trump sitting there on 285. Are the people anointing him as the nominee maybe getting ahead of themselves, Mike?
No, I think that he is nearly there, and I think that
makes you say that? Because I mean, just cold hard math says that he's got quite a way to go.
Right, but the fact that he has been pulling in 35-36%, but the fact that the field is still very much split, the fact that Cruz and Rubio and Kasich and Carson are still there in the race, and that makes it all very easy for him. I mean, at some stage earlier that there'd been other people had left the race and it had been far fewer, then I think it would have been a different position. But it's there, and he's doing very well, and he's picking up states, as Stuart was saying, which you perhaps weren't expecting.
I think one thing to look at in the Republican tally is that Cruz should have a much higher delegate count than that, given the fact that we had yesterday evangelical Christian states. He should have done much better there than he did.
Rubio was once his firewall, wasn't it?
Exactly. Exactly. And he was predicting yesterday as a kind of big Jimmy Carter moment when he would sort of race ahead a few weeks ago, and that didn't happen at all. Rubio is clearly struggling. His big state comes up, which is Florida, his home state. One of the things Trump has in his favor is that the others all have reason to stay in the race. And as long as they all have reason, Cruz, because he thinks he's the only conservative, credible opponent, as you hear him say now every minute. Rubio, because his big winner-takes-all state with a lot of delegates is coming up. And the others, I think, because they think that if they can tie Trump into not hitting that 1,237 milestone before the convention, then all bets are off, because it goes to the convention and a very convoluted process, or so-called brokered convention, begins, which could result in someone who didn't get the most delegates winning. So there's different reasons for all the candidates why it's worth sticking in the race. And in a funny way, that helps Trump, because if he keeps getting 35% state after state, he'll get a lot of delegates quite quickly.
I think we've got some of the key dates in March to look ahead to. And, you know, March 15th is the one that everyone's looking at, which obviously has Florida and Ohio on the same day. Interesting fact, I believe Hillary Clinton won Florida, Ohio, California, and another as well, New York as well. So, you know, maybe winning all of these big states isn't necessarily the be-all and the end-all, but certainly there's a lot of delegates still to come, Mike, isn't there?
The very key states on March the 15th are, as we see on the screen, Florida with its 99 delegates and Ohio with its 66 delegates. And Ohio, Kasich, he's the governor there, and if he is going to win a state, that would be the state he'd win, and that's a lot of delegates in terms of the overall target. And Florida, that's Rubio's home state.
If he doesn't win Florida, he's done, isn't he?
Yeah, but if you add those two states up, if you look at the overall mathematics going forward, that is actually the secret of Trump not achieving the plurality on delegates that he's going to need.
I'm interested in this idea of a contested convention, because, of course, yeah, there is this narrative which you spoke about earlier that says, actually, you know, it might be about denying Donald Trump the majority, if you like, rather than actually beating him. But surely, in reality, that's going to be something that, A, is quite difficult to do, as you mentioned, because of his ability to win that 35% and maybe win the plurality of the vote in a sort of 4 or 5 person race. Yeah. But also, you know, politically, can the Republican establishment really go into a convention when Donald Trump's won the most votes, the most states, and deny him the nomination?
Well, I think that's a very good point. In fact, Trump last night, after the Super Tuesday results, was speaking very much in terms of himself as someone who keeps winning, which I think was a signal that if it ever came to the grandees deciding, I think that the fact that he's won so many, would have won so many races, I think it does count in his favour. There's other problems, though. I mean, the establishment can't unite behind a particular candidate. You've seen Chris Christie astonishingly backing Donald Trump. Lindsey Graham, senior senator, looking as though he might reluctantly back Ted Cruz. So there isn't really...
And he joked about shooting him about a week.
Exactly. I mean, there isn't really an anti-Trump sort of unanimous view. There's an anti-establishment view amongst primary voters, but that's split between Cruz and Trump. So it's sort of all over the place. And the second issue is, it's not clear what strategy you pursue if you do want to stop Trump. Is it better to keep everyone in the race? And as Mike says, for the Cruz to win Texas, as he did last night, Kasich to win Ohio, Rubio to win Florida, and then kind of have a stalemate? Or is it better to drop out and unite? But if you drop out and unite, the voters have to go the way that the candidates want. And it's not clear that, apart from Rubio supporters, who pretty much are anti-Trump, that the supporters of other candidates are as unanimously anti-Trump as maybe a lot of Washington Republicans
would
like.
Some go to Trump, and you know, you don't need many to go here and there. A percentage point here, a percentage point there, and he boosts his
Indeed.
Support, doesn't he?
Yeah.
There was a very interesting intervention by Mitt Romney a couple of days ago, calling on Trump to make a declaration, his tax return declaration. In 2012, Mitt Romney was chased all over the place and eventually came up with the details. I mean, clearly the guy's very rich and didn't particularly want the world to know that. Why is Trump being so fiercely hostile to showing his tax returns? And one of the theories is that maybe he isn't as rich as he says he is.
It's amazing how he's turned his wealth into an extraordinary asset, because it's for wealth, read independence from influence.
Yeah,
and success.
It wasn't for Romney.
One thing that last night did show, there's some evidence from some of the American papers I was reading today that last minute sort of vicious anti-Trump language did have an effect on late deciders. Mm. And I think that one of the straws that the non-Trump candidates will be clutching to is that I think you'll see a lot more sort of attacking of Trump in the way that you've seen in the last few days. I think some people think that might make a dent in it.
In the final couple of minutes of this segment, I mean, if it is Trump and Clinton, the conventional wisdom is Hillary Clinton wallops him in the general. Is that wishful thinking, or maybe getting ahead of ourselves?
Well, I think that's probably, if you're a betting person, that's what you put your money on. But I don't think it's anywhere near a certainty. I mean, I think one of the things that is astonishing about Trump is that he defies the normal left-right categories. And for those people who think Trump is too right-wing to win a general election, a presidential election, I think that's the wrong way of thinking about him. I think you're already seeing him start to tack back to more popular positions, less aggressive, less sort of making a name for himself, no matter how much dirt he dishes. I think there's a different
tone.
Kind of
was very different in his speech.
Absolutely,
last time,
absolutely. And I think the sort of populist anti-establishment card might well get a lot of independent voters, and will be a more difficult proposition than some people are predicting. Nevertheless, I still think Hillary's probably the favourite.
I think one of the great strengths that the Hillary campaign has got is that Trump himself is such a polarising figure. Trump will be the great turnout driver.
Absolutely, yeah.
And people I know who are working on the Hillary campaign are just they're finding it coming out all the time. Because of the history, and it's for so long, is going to find it quite hard. I mean, she's very much old school, but she is the non-Trump, and I think that will help on the election day, November the 8th.
And if you look at the polling on this, and YouGov did a big piece on this today, that liberals clearly overwhelmingly support Hillary, conservatives broadly overwhelmingly support Trump, moderates in the middle tend to side with Hillary on the big issues. And so I think in a way that's her fertile ground, and I think you'll see a lot, as Mike said, of Hillary's campaign hitting the drumbeat of "Would you trust your country to this man?" That sort of theme I think you'll see a lot more of in a Hillary campaign.
That was part one of the politicalbetting.com Polling Matters podcast this week. Certainly Super Tuesday was a very interesting event, if you like, on the electoral calendar. There will be many people that assume now that Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton is the inevitable contest. I suppose nothing is inevitable in politics, but it certainly looks that way when you consider, as I think Stuart was mentioning, that, you know, who is this alternative candidate that's going to emerge? It's not so much that there isn't a path for someone else to beat him, it's just, who is that going to be? When you look at the different candidates, John Kasich, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, they all have their constituencies, they all have their strengths, but they all have their weaknesses as well. So it's not clear who, if anybody, will be able to topple Trump. But also, you know, even if they do deny him this majority of delegates, and you know that he needs to clinch the nomination at the convention on the first ballot, you know, ultimately, if he wins the most votes in the most states, you know, I don't think he'd react too kindly to being screwed out of the nomination, do you? I don't think that's something that this guy would take lying down. So a long way back for the Republicans that don't want Donald Trump, although for those that do, they must be very, very happy indeed. On the Democrat side, Hillary Clinton does now look inevitable, and I guess her team will have to be focusing on just how they handle Trump in the general election, because although there's lots of things going for her in terms of the ratings of Hispanics and sort of black voters of Donald Trump, the negative ratings, I should say, she's got her own troubles with the ongoing email scandal and her own sort of ratings when it comes to trust and things like that. So she's very much the favourite, rightly so. She's the most experienced candidate. I still think if you put a gun to my head, I think you know, she's the next president. But then, you know, if it's a one-on-one race, who knows? So that was Super Tuesday. The second half of this conversation and final half was me, Stuart, and Mike talking about events closer to home. We started off talking about some recent polling that's come out about the Tories and the EU referendum, certainly looking good for Boris Johnson. And then we moved on, as Stuart is a Labour peer, to talk a little bit about Labour and what we might expect from them in May. It's all gone rather quiet on the Corbyn leadership front, if you like. He certainly seems quite strong if you look at his ratings among his own supporters, but maybe that might change if Labour has a particularly bad May. But will they have a bad May? You know, maybe they won't. Maybe it'll be like Oldham all over again and they'll surpass expectations. So I started off the second half of the show by describing some of the polling around the EU referendum and Boris right now, and we discussed a little bit about what that means. Guys, we had some new polling out today, which I thought was very interesting, looking at the views of Conservative members, which showed that Boris Johnson very much the favoured candidate in a hypothetical leadership contest, and also the Conservative membership more likely to want to leave the European Union than remain, by a margin of 59% to 31%. I mean, all of this suggests that Boris Johnson's announcement recently that he wanted to support the Leave campaign was shrewd politics. Well, I mean, Mike, what do you think?
I think it was shrewd politics. I think that with Boris, you assume that his main motivation is Boris. He wants to be Prime Minister. He wants to be the big figure. He wants to be king of the world. I think that was his objective as a child. And looking at it, that he's in the best place. And I think that even if Remain win. But if Remain win by a small margin, then he still comes out of it very well. Cameron says he starts going in 2018, 2019, and Boris is the one that the party will go towards. And it's very difficult to see anything other than that. I think the other great strength that George Osborne has got in all of this is that there are so many people within the MPs within the party who've actually owe their position to the way that that he has sort of promoted them and given them and preferment, and I think that that will have a make a difference. And if you remember the way the Tory system works, the MPs have an exhaustive system of ballots, and they decide on two members who will go forward to the membership.
I suspect there'll be certain elements of the Labour Party that maybe regret not having a similar system.
Well, remember that Michael Portillo in 2001, clearly the best candidate, didn't make the final two.
I mean, Stuart, what's your take on the current state of the EU referendum campaign? It always strikes me that, you know, the status quo, whatever that might be, whether it's the current electoral system or remaining in the EU, has something of an inbuilt advantage. The alternative campaign always has to have that sort of threshold of risk and change to get over. I mean, do you think Remain is still in a strong position?
Yeah, I agree with you. There is a sort of structural advantage in status quo position in this. I think particularly at a time of economic concern, not just in Britain but elsewhere, I think that helps the case. I think the downside, though, is that all the romance belongs to the Exiters rather than the Remainers. And you might think that's a luxury that isn't really part of bread and butter politics. But I think when you hear people talk about staying in the EU or leaving the EU, that there's a sort of intellectual energy behind the exit case, which I think the Remain case is concerned about and needs to match. And I suspect that the biggest problem with the exit case is painting a picture of what it's like for Britain to leave the European Union and saying we wouldn't have a deal like Norway or Switzerland, we'll have our own deal. I think, as with the Scottish, the case the SNP and the Yes case in Scotland found, painting a picture of what Scotland would be like outside the UK with regard to Europe, NATO and currency was a problem for them. I think a similar problem for the exiters in this will come through in the next 2 or 3 months. So I think that's the sort of contours of how the argument will go.
And it was interesting on my podcast last week, we had Douglas Carswell on, and I'd certainly recommend people check that one out. But he kept talking about the riskier option being to remain, and that might sound like a bit of a stretch, but it was interesting that he was trying to tackle that narrative. Clearly the Leave campaign are worried about this idea of it being too risky.
Yeah, and I mean, I think this is it's not as though this is a time of huge stability inside the European Union, particularly with regard to migration and the operation of the euro. That there's enough there, I think, for the leavers to sort of press on and say, well, look, it's not clear that there's a safe option just by staying in. So it is more volatile than perhaps it would have been 3 or 4 years ago, or even 15 years ago, if you'd have had a referendum in that sense.
I think that what you're going to see Remain do, the final message is that the time is not ripe. There might be a case for change, but the time is not ripe. There's so much uncertainty. There's so many potential difficulties, and people will, I think they hope, will not want to take the risk. That's certainly the way that the Scottish referendum played out. The sort of the whole messaging, it gets negative, but it's negative properly. Will at the end of the
that
day
may
work?
Be right. Although I think you could be right. What you said earlier that I suspect Remain will win. I personally hope they do, but I think they probably will. But it could be that for a while the future, particularly inside the Conservative Party, belongs to people who are leavers rather than Remainers.
Yes.
Even if Remain wins the case for the country, it'll be almost like the sort of you'll be branded with your position you took in the 2015 referendum for quite a while.
Forever.
And I think that could be it could sort of see the way that careers bifurcate inside the Tory Party. Well, maybe even inside our party in a smaller way, much smaller way.
But I mean, what happened to Labour
in the Tory party.
After the 1975 referendum? Those who were for or those who were against, that was with them for the rest of their careers. And indeed, you saw the split off of the SDP, which basically came from the referendum campaign in 75.
I mean, I wouldn't rule out Theresa May if we're talking about Tory leadership consequences of the referendum. I think Theresa May is, for many Tories, an appealing combination of true believer, very strong sceptic of the EU, but on loyalty grounds, probably mainly, she's decided not to put her head above the parapet and she's going to sort of back the Prime Minister. But you won't hear much from her, I suspect, in the next 3 months. That may be quite an appealing combination because Boris, I think, will have earned the hatred of a lot of people in Parliament. I think George Osborne's fate rests largely with the economy, although Mike's right, he has a lot of friends because of patronage. It could be Theresa May is one to watch in the next few months.
It's also going to be interesting to see what impact Boris Johnson coming out for Leave will have on the public and how strongly he actually sort of participates in that campaign and is seen to lead it. I always think that the Prime Minister advocating any position is always a strong hurdle for its opponents to overcome on such an issue like this. But let's talk a little bit about the Labour Party. I mean, obviously, almost anonymous in some of this debate in a way, perhaps because the party is so at least perceived to be united on this issue. Stuart, how does the Labour Party tackle this referendum? On the one hand, great, united behind Remain, fantastic, no splits there necessarily. But on the other hand, does the Labour Party want to have the look of being the sort of pro-EU, sort of supportive of a status quo on the immigration party? Is there a risk that they might suffer in certain areas of the country, much like they did in Scotland after the sort of independence referendum? Could there be a sort of UKIP surge in certain Labour areas as a result of Labour's policy on this issue?
There's definitely different strains in the Labour Party on this. I think it's fair to say that there is a small split, but it's nowhere near as big as the Conservative. And there is the minority of Labour MPs in particular, a very small minority who I think are leavers. Most people are Remainers, but within that group, there are different kinds of people. There are people who are strong enthusiasts for the European Union and want to be on the front foot. And Alan Johnson, as you know, is leading the Labour sort of part of the campaign there. And then there are people, I think Jeremy Corbyn's one of these people actually, who are sceptical of a lot of what the European Union does from a sort of social democratic left point of view, but who I think on balance think for lots of reasons it's not the right thing to do to back Leave. I actually think those people, including Corbyn, might be quite important to persuade people who are worried about the left from a point of view of social policy or democracy, a sort of democratic deficit, that it's worth sticking with the EU. I mean, but then there are people who are pro-EU and worry about the immigration side, and I think a lot of those people just want to sort of keep their heads down for 3 or 4 months, to be honest. And I think you'll see quite a lot of MPs doing that.
In the meantime, Labour's hurtling towards its own sort of clash with the electorate, however you want to phrase it, you know, the May elections, the local elections, as I mentioned, devolved elections in Scotland and Wales, but also the London mayoral election. What's your assessment of the situation the party faces going into those contests? It seems from the national polling that Jeremy Corbyn's leadership ratings are, to be fair, not very good. I mean, yeah, they're some of the worst that we've seen from a leader of the opposition taking over. The voting intention polls for Westminster polls are, as we might expect, somewhat overlooked and disregarded at the moment. What's your sense of where Labour is going into those contests?
Well, I mean, the Labour Party in Westminster is, let's be honest, not in a great place. I mean, there's a lot of hostility towards Jeremy amongst the parliamentary Labour Party. Not all, but some significant sections of it. I think there are three sort of issues which are, if you like, the lowest bar that I think that Labour leadership will be looking to get over. One is winning the London mayoralty election, where I think Sadiq Khan has a very good chance of winning that. Yeah. The second is not coming third in Scotland. Now, that might sound like an incredibly low bar, but because
sound
of the
Marco
way...
Marco Rubio now.
Because yes, exactly, my 3-3-3 strategy. Because of the polling has looked... Occasionally, the Tories have looked as though they're going into second place there. I'm not saying it's enough for Jeremy Corbyn and the team, but I definitely think that they need to knock that on the head as decisively as possible. And then thirdly, I think that, I mean, these seats, as I remember, that are coming up from the local elections this time round, are ones that when I worked for Ed, we won in 2012. I think we made about 800 seat gains around there. Is that right, Mike?
It was colossal.
And it was probably our best moment in the local election. Now, I don't think that it's difficult to give a yardstick for what Jeremy Corbyn's team should do in order to satisfy that. I mean, I think the national percentage vote will be probably the most important thing. You know, Labour should be looking to be very competitive, if not ahead, and be making gains. And some people will say that the gain should be much more than that, and you know, maybe they're right. But I think at the very least, that's what Corbyn's team needs to be looking at. So those are the three things I would keep my eyes on, really.
Because the seats that are being contested, the council seats, are those which were won in 2012, just after George Osborne's omni-shambles as a budget. Yeah. Labour was all over the place. The Tories were in a really terrible mess. And I think that the trouble is, you say, made 800 gains, and that means it's going to be much, much harder.
Yeah, exactly.
Local elections require a big activist base. It's much more, because you've got turnouts 25, 35%, and you've just got to get the vote out.
This all being said, of course, polling from YouGov recently, released by Ian Warren from Election Data, shows the membership full square behind Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. So even if the results were terrible, the likelihood is Jeremy Corbyn's around for the foreseeable future, isn't it?
I think that's probably right, although I don't think that's the only factor that matters. But I think that, I mean, in a way, Bernie Sanders has a slight version of this issue, a huge number of people who support, and then the question is whether they'll show up in the actual campaigns or not. And a lot of Labour MPs are worried about that. I think that's for the people who've signed up to prove Labour MPs wrong. I think the machine, as it were, that the Corbyn campaign assembled has to really show that it can deliver for the party as a whole. That's one of the tests, I think, that a lot of MPs in particular are looking at the moment for the local elections.
Stuart Wood there talking about the Labour Party's prospects for May. Certainly is going to be one to watch when you consider that there are many people within the parliamentary Labour Party that would be rather happy to see the back of Jeremy Corbyn. But I suspect that there will be no silver bullets in the Labour Party after May. I think that, you know, if Labour wins the London mayoralty and, does okay in Scotland, even if it doesn't do very well in England, I think there'll be enough ambiguity there to maintain Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, particularly when you consider how popular he is among the grassroots Labour supporters. And speaking of the grassroots, it will certainly be interesting to see how Boris Johnson manages to navigate this EU referendum campaign, given his sort of not particularly subtle sort of ambitions towards the Tory leadership. But that will all be something to keep in mind in the future. A big thanks to my guests this week, Stuart Wood and Mike Smithson. And if you haven't checked out the YouTube video of us in the studio already, do check that out. It's a lot of fun, and we'll be very interested to see what people's feedback is. There's also a segment on the YouTube version this week where Mike talks to Graham Sharp of William Hill about some of the betting around the topics we've discussed this week. So if you're interested in the betting, do check out the YouTube video. But for now, that's all we've got time for. If you like what you hear on the podcast, do give us a sort of rating in iTunes, or subscribe, or leave a comment if you have iTunes, of course. Otherwise, you know, share us on social media, on Twitter, give the Facebook page a like. It all helps spread our audience and get our name out there, and it's very much appreciated. But for now, the music you're about to hear is Pollinate by Kirk Pearson, licensed under a Creative Commons. Thanks for listening.